happy to hear. Well, it's a great honour to be here, folks, and thanks very much for coming. I've always wanted to tour Montana because I grew up in a hunting, fishing family, and I used to be able to read Field and Stream magazines, and I would read about elk hunting in Montana and catching big lake trout and that, so it's really nice to look around the place. You've got a beautiful state here. But most of all, I think what you've got is people who want to be free and independent and are very jealously guarding that freedom, and that's really great to be amongst. I want to tell a little story before I start. Any California refugees here tonight? You'll understand this. I was in Los Angeles not long ago, and I walked up to a street vendor to buy some food. I gave the guy the money, and he looked at me and said, "Wow, you've got an accent. Like, where are you from?" I said, "Look, I'm from New Zealand." He said, "Well, where's that?" So, to make it easy for him, I said, "Look, it's down near Australia." He said, "Oh, where Arnold Schwarzenegger comes from." And I'm sure he votes, people. But, look, everybody always asks me, I've been to more than, I think, all of the lower 48, I've spoken to more than 400 audiences in the last few years. And everybody always asks me, why do I care about America? And I say there are two reasons. The first is simple gratitude. You know, my country was facing invasion during World War II from the Imperial Japanese Army. They were coming down through the Pacific. And if it hadn't been for the sacrifice of your fathers and uncles and grandfathers at the battles of Guadalcanal and the Coral Sea and Midway, we would have been done, folks. And that's a very strong memory in my country today. The second reason is related, but it's a little more selfish. You know, Ronald Reagan had it right. This is the last best hope for mankind. If freedom should ever fail in America, if you ever lose your constitution, your liberty, your economic dynamism, and your military superiority, all of which took a major trashing through the Obama years, if that trend had continued, we would be living in a world run out of Moscow and Beijing and Tehran. We'd be living in a world full of tyrants, people. Is that the kind of world you want to leave to your children and grandchildren?
No.
So, it's, you know, people often say to me, you know, "Look, if things turn bad in America, can I come and live in New Zealand? You know, it's really safe down there, right?" So come down, you'll love the country, it's beautiful, you'll have a great time, but you'll need to learn Chinese. Seriously, people, a few years ago, about 3 years ago, the Australian Minister of Defence, and if you're not sure where Australia is, it's a little island off our west coast, okay? Just get that straight. But anyway, the Australian Minister of Defence was up in China for talks, and a top Chinese general publicly said to him, "Now is the time for Australia to choose. You need a godfather. Will it be an American godfather or a Chinese godfather? If you are smart, you will choose China, because we are the growing power in the region." Well, how do you think that makes us feel, people? We understand that if America goes down, we follow. There's no getting away from it. Who's going to lead the free world if you don't, folks? Ireland or Italy or Liechtenstein, perhaps? Who's going to do it?
Because you guys are disarmed. So
we're completely disarmed. We don't even have an air force. We can't carry sidearms. You know, we can have guns for hunting, but you can't have them for self-defense. And you know the only reason you have a Second Amendment, it's not for hunting, it's to protect you from an overreaching government. Amen. And if you don't have your Second Amendment, your First Amendment will be gone very soon afterwards, as will all the rest of them. Now, I want to talk about national security today. Because I think that's the most important issue, really. If you can't secure your own country, nothing else really matters. But I want to talk about an aspect of it that is not often discussed. Now, I'm sure there are a lot of military people here and first responders who have taken that famous oath. I pledge to defend the Constitution from all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, we all understand the foreign enemies, you know, ISIS and Iran and, you know, China, etc., North Korea. But how many people are talking about the internal enemies, people? And which are more dangerous? An enemy wearing a foreign uniform standing at your gate, or an enemy wearing a suit and tie working in your highest levels of Congress or the US Senate? Who's more dangerous?
Insiders.
Absolutely. So I want to ask, has anybody in this room ever had to undergo any form of FBI background check to hold a government or civilian position? No one at all? Oh, four or five? Gentlemen over there. Is it true that those background checks can be very comprehensive? They can go through your underwear drawers practically. You know, they'll interview your school friends. They will check out your family background, overseas travel, your financial stability, even bounce checks. They'll check out criminal convictions, drug convictions, the whole lot. Because they understand that the federal government is really the heart of the free world. Your government is the most powerful government in the world. It's keeping the world together. But you have enemies who have a history of using your weak and dishonest to betray you. They need to know that you're going to be a loyal servant to the Constitution. I had a friend in Virginia who applied for a mid-level federal government job in Washington, D.C. The FBI sent two agents all the way to Canada to interview that man's communist uncle. And on the strength of that interview, my friend, a staunch conservative, was denied that position. Not because he was a communist, because his uncle was a communist. And that was just too close for the position that he wanted to hold. And I actually support that, folks, because this is the national security of the most important country in the world, and you don't want to be taking risks. You might be in charge of you might be guarding the president someday. You might be in charge of a nuclear facility. You might be in charge of writing education policy. You may not be a loyal servant to the Constitution. But what if you're a young Marxist radical or a young Muslim Brotherhood supporter who hangs around with the local Democratic Party? And the communists have taken over that branch, which they have all over the country. And they get you, they can put a suit and tie on you and get you elected to Congress or even the US Senate, where you may serve on the Armed Services Committee or the Homeland Security Committee or even the Intelligence Committee of the House of Representatives, overseeing all 16 of your intelligence agencies. How much of an FBI background check do you need for that one, folks? Zero. Big, fat zero. Because the people are supposed to vet the candidates, right? And the media is supposed to help you do it, right? Well, how's that been working out for you guys? See the problem? So you can be a young Marxist radical. You could get elected to Congress and serve on this high-ranking, very influential, very top-secret government committees with access to all sorts of top-secret information, and there's no background checks whatsoever. Do you think your enemies might be aware of that little loophole?
We got a president beforehand.
Sorry?
Had a previous president.
Well, I'm going to talk to you, exactly. Do you think Barack Obama could possibly pass a background check? So you're in there, you get in there, the media's not going to touch you, there's no background checks, And all these foreign intelligence services are interested in you because you're a very important legislator. You're one of the most important legislators in the world. You're a leader of the world's most powerful country. Now, up in the United Nations in New York, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of foreign intelligence officers working under diplomatic cover. And you very generously pay their rent, you know, which I think you should stop doing real quick. But anyway, they're up there from North Korea, from Iran, from Cuba, from Venezuela, from China, from Russia, from Saudi Arabia, all sorts of hostile or semi-hostile countries. Now, those people are working with your congressman. They're holding parties. They invite them to little events at their embassy. They go on picnics with their families. They work to cultivate your congressmen and senators. That is their job. And if they know some of your congressmen and senators are sympathetic to the communist movements, come from the communist movements, are sympathetic to the Muslim Brotherhood, or other radical organizations, do you not think they might try and recruit them to their cause? So they have all these opportunities. So you imagine if you're a North Korean intelligence officer and you've spent 5 years in the United States whining and dining these congressmen, and you go back home to North Korea, to Pyongyang, and your great leader invites you to a little get-together in the palace. And then you sit down in front of him and he says to you, "We gave you 5 years in America. How many American congressmen did you recruit for us?" And you say, "Oh, well, none really." How's that going to go for your career, people? How's that going to go for your family? How's that going to go for your future? So there's tremendous pressure on these people to recruit your congressman. There's no background checks whatsoever. You think it might be happening a little bit? You have got the kid, you know, recently under Obama, after many years, there was a start on a normalization of relations with Cuba. That was driven by your congressional black caucus, about 40 members. It was basically set up by Cuba as their agency inside your Congress. Many of the members have worked with the Cubans for decades. Barbara Lee has been down there 22 times up to last year. The purpose of this is to loosen trade and travel restrictions on Cuba, so it's much more easy for them to infiltrate their agents into this country, where they can start more LA riots, more Ferguson riots, send more drugs to your country, and more spies to your country. And the big bait they use is agricultural trade, etc., which is why John Tester was down in Cuba not too long ago doing exactly the same thing. Yes, you will make some money trading with Cuba, but the price you will pay is far going to exceed any money you make from those people, folks. Dealing with the Cuban communists is like dealing with the mafia. They want a price. Now, what do you call people? Dozens of your congressmen have gone down to Cuba to work with the Cubans to basically make it easy for the Cubans to take down your country. What do you call people who go to a foreign country to help that country against your country? And what's the penalty for that one, folks? So why is it happening every day on a regular basis and nobody does a darn thing about it? It's endemic, people. It's absolutely endemic in your Congress. And it's been going on for a very long time. I want to ask the people here, any Vietnam veterans in the room tonight? Quite a few. Well, the first thing, gentlemen, I'll say is thank you. Then, if I may, I would like to ask a couple of questions. One of them is very stupid, but I think you'll see where I'm going. The first one is, was the Vietnam War lost in the jungles of Vietnam?
No.
Every veteran says the same thing. Is it true that you weren't really allowed to fight that war to win it? You weren't allowed to invade North Vietnam. You weren't allowed to mine Haiphong Harbour. Often you couldn't chase the enemy in hot pursuits. Sometimes there were some pretty tough rules of engagement. Is any of that true? So here's a dumb question. Had you been allowed to fight that war to actually win it, like you were in World War II, to invade North Vietnam, take the fight right to the heart of the enemy, could you have won that war and pretty darn quickly?
Yes.
Every veteran tells me that. Well, this is what was happening, people. Here's an example of what was going on. Dean Rusk, who was your Secretary of State at that time, I got this story from Admiral Ace Lyons, the former commander of the Pacific Fleet. So I put a lot of credibility into it. Dean Rusk, your Secretary of State, every night he would get the bombing orders for North Vietnam the next day. He would get the list of the targets that your bombers were going to hit the next day. And every day he would send that list to the Swedish embassy in Washington, who would pass it on to the North Vietnamese. So they knew exactly where to bring all of their guns. So when your airmen flew over the next day, they had it perfectly. They were sitting ducks. How many of your airmen do you think died or were captured or shot down because of that man's treason, people? And then, when you withdrew from that war, your government, your Congress, defunded the South Vietnamese military, basically guaranteeing a communist takeover. Is that true?
Yes.
Well, I say this, people. That war was deliberately sabotaged in your Congress by congressmen like Father Drynan from Massachusetts, who are working hand in glove with the Communist Party USA, which was taking its orders directly from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, which was allied to the Communist Party of North Vietnam. You think there might have been a little bit of treason going on there, people?
Yes.
And how many of... So you lost, in that war, you lost 58,000 of your boys, folks. 58,000 young Americans, your school buddies, your high school football buddies, your hunting buddies, your uncles, your cousins, maybe even your father. 58,000 young Americans died. Hundreds of thousands were wounded. Millions of Vietnamese suffered death, imprisonment, torture, and execution after the communist victory. How many of the traitors in your Congress who can deliberately condemn tens of thousands of your boys to unnecessary deaths in a war they were not allowed to win, how many of them paid a single penalty for what they did, folks?
No.
One of them was Obama's Secretary of State, Mr. John Kerry, otherwise known as Jane Fonda with less testosterone. And what about John Conyers, people? He was one of them. How long has he, John Conyers, a rep from Michigan, how long has he been there now? 140, 160 years, perhaps? John Conyers, I regard as your most dangerous congressman. And the reason I say that is because he has been, through most of his career, a high-ranking member of the Judiciary Committee. He's a lawyer by trade. The Judiciary Committee is the body that sets federal law, and it's also the body that has oversight over the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Now, which organization is supposed to be rooting the traitors and spies and terrorists out of your government, folks? The FBI. So on the Judiciary Committee, you also have a woman called Judy Chu from California, who is a long-time supporter of the pro-Chinese Communist Workers' Party. She has actively worked to promote trade between California and China and has been described in the Chinese press as China's best friend in your Congress. And you want to see Judy Chu go off on the FBI when they have the temerity to arrest one of the thousands of Chinese spies operating in your country. You want to see the hard time Judy Chu gives them, people? You are racist. You are singling these people out because you hate Chinese. That is what Judy Chu does in your Congress. And then you have Jerry Nadler, the congressman from New York, a longtime member of your largest Marxist group, Democratic Socialists of America, which now has 5 chapters in Montana.
Wow.
Yep, they worked with John Tester quite nicely. They worked with, they invited Steve Bullock to one of their meetings very recently. But Jerry Nadler, remember when ACORN, the radical group, was getting a hard time about 5 or 6, 7 or 8 years ago in your Congress? They were going to have an investigation into ACORN, and it's scams, it's vote fraud, it's rip-offs. Well, ACORN is a front for Democratic Socialists of America. And that investigation got shut down. And who shut it down? DSA member, Democratic Socialists of America member, Jerry Nadler, on the Judiciary Committee. And then you have Luis Gutierrez from Illinois. Luis Gutierrez was a former leader of the pro-Cuban Marxist-Leninist Puerto Rican Socialist Party, which did not stop him also serving on the Intelligence Committee. But Mr. Gutierrez was elected by several Maoist groups into your Congress and is very actively involved in several Muslim Brotherhood front groups. And if you're not sure, the Muslim Brotherhood is the father of Hamas and Al-Qaeda and ISIS. It is a terrorist organization in Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Russia, but in America it operates openly through the Council on American-Islamic Relations, the Muslim American Students Association, which has a branch in Bozeman, and several other front groups. And then you go back to John Conyers himself. This is the man who has been the chairman of the Judiciary Committee for many, many years and is now the ranking Democrat. John Conyers has a 50-year history with the Communist Party USA, a 40-year history with Democratic Socialists of America. He was at their founding conference. He's got a 30-year history with the Workers' World Party. These are the people that tear down Confederate statues in North Carolina, by the way. This is a group that supports North Korea and Cuba and Iran and is extensively involved and several Muslim Brotherhood front groups. John Conyers is a hardcore anti-American Marxist-Leninist. As hardcore as you can get, folks. Yet he is the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee. Was the chairman. It was John Conyers who abolished your House Un-American Activities Committee, folks. The body that used to investigate radicals and subversives in this country. Who do you think told John Conyers to do that, people? Probably his friends in the Communist Party USA and his bosses in the old Soviet Union, I would venture to guess. So you're a young Marxist radical. You get elected to Congress. The media's not going to touch you. There's no security checks. Then if ever the FBI wants to come after you, what do you think they're going to say to John Conyers and Judy Chu and Jerry Nadler and Luis Gutierrez? Can we please have some money to investigate your comrades? How do you think that's going to go? What do you think's going to happen to their budget next year, folks? You think the FBI is stupid enough to bite the hand that feeds it? Why do you think Mr. Comey, with all the evidence he had, the head of the FBI, with all the evidence he had on Hillary Clinton and her treason, didn't want to prosecute? What do you think would have happened to the FBI had he prosecuted and she won the election? You think there could have been a problem? That is how you are so deeply infiltrated, people. Because the media doesn't deal with these people. There's no security checks in Congress, and the security bodies in your Congress have been infiltrated by the enemy. Look, take for example Mr. John Tester. You know, good looking guy, you know, nice haircut and cowboy hat and all this kind of thing. He's one of yours, right?
No.
He's not one of the worst in Congress, in the Senate, but I'll say this. John Tester was recently at a meeting of WOLA, which was the Washington Office on Latin America. This is a pro-Cuban Marxist group. Yet Mr. Tester was there partying with them, and he has led the charge to open up Cuba to trade from your state and others, been down to Cuba with a Senate delegation. He is also sponsored and financed by an organization called the Council for a Livable World. Sounds wonderful. We all want a livable world, right? The Council for a Livable World was set up in 1962 by a man called Leo Szilard, a former Hungarian communist who worked in the Manhattan Project producing your first atomic bomb and was regarded as a major security risk, a very dangerous security risk. They wanted to get rid of him, but he was such an important scientist, they kept him. But he set up this group in 1962, and its purpose was to fund Senate races in low population states. They would get a whole bunch of money from liberal donors. They'd go to small states and they'd get behind a senator that they could get elected with not too much money. And John Tester was one of them. They would then pressure these senators to always vote to cut American military spending, to cut weapons programs, to cut your nuclear arsenal, to cut anything that might be a danger to the Soviet Union or Russia. And John Tester was funded and financed by this group. Leo Szilard was identified by a defecting KGB officer as a fully recruited officer of the Soviet KGB. So your John Tester was funded into your Senate, into the US Senate, by an organization set up by a Soviet spy. If they investigated John Tester's background, do you think he'd be allowed to serve as a, you know, clean out the latrines in your local military base? But he's in your Senate, people. Right now, in this state, this very conservative state. This is how deeply the enemy has infiltrated this country. There are at least 100 members of your House and 20 members of your Senate who are so enmeshed in neo-communist groups or Muslim Brotherhood front groups or both, they couldn't pass a basic FBI background check. You know, you want to be a realtor, you got to pass one. You want to work in the post office, you have to pass one. But you don't have to pass an FBI background check to serve on the Intelligence Committee of the House of Representatives. Is there a little bit of a potential problem there, do you think?
Yeah.
Now, I want to talk about what I regard now as the single most urgent national security threat you face today. And it isn't Iran, and it isn't North Korea, it is illegal immigration. And I want to explain why this is more dangerous than all of those other threats, maybe all those other threats combined. Now, the push to illegal immigration, the big movement to encouraging this, started out in California in the 1950s with a Communist Party member named Bert Corona. He was a very active Stalinist. He was also a Democrat, as many of them are. And he set up the Viva Kennedy Clubs in the early 60s, the first organized effort to bring Latinos into the Democratic Party. He was a big friend of the Kennedy family. Now, the purpose of these groups, which were funded with a lot of money out of Chicago from Saul Alinsky. Who knows who Saul Alinsky was? Yep. He was a radical Marxist community organizer out of Chicago, who basically was a mentor to Hillary Clinton and an inspiration to Barack Obama. So he said he got this money and he set up a whole network through Southern California into right across to Texas, across New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona, the whole lot. And the purpose of these groups was to encourage illegals across the border to get them work in factories and farms and get them settled, get their kids into schools, and get them settled on this side of the border. Now, Corona died in 2002, but he trained hundreds of people, if not thousands, to carry on his work for him. And three of them work very closely together today in Southern California. They're a little clique, and they have transformed that state. And the spillover is transforming your state and many others. The first member of this little group is a man called Antonio Villagarosa. He was until recently the mayor of Los Angeles, and he may be California's next governor. He's a hardcore Marxist. He used to go down to Cuba to cut sugarcane for the Castro brothers. He is the man who basically amped up. California was, Los Angeles was a sanctuary city since 1979, but he blew it, he really blew it out. He forbade the LAPD from enforcing immigration laws, and the illegals flooded into to Orange County and LA County in the hundreds of thousands. Totally transformed the whole area. The second member of this little group is a man called Gil Cedillo, a Communist Party supporter. You heard that recently California gave driver's licenses to illegals.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that was organized by Gil Cedillo. He was until recently the Democratic head of the California State Senate. The third member of this little group, the most powerful woman in California, I believe, she now serves on the Democratic National Committee. Her name is Maria Elena D'Arazzo, a hardcore Marxist, and until recently the head of the California AFL-CIO, the top unionist, labor unionist in that state. Now, Maria Elena D'Arazzo is behind the massive union-driven and union-paid-for Latino voter registration drives and get-out-the-vote efforts that added hundreds of thousands of new Latino voters to the California rolls in the last 15 years. And guess which party they voted for by a margin of 4-1, people? 80% Democrats. The result of this deliberate Marxist program has been to turn California from the most from a reddish purplish state to solidly blue. Even Orange County, once the most conservative county in the United States, is now blue because of these people. They got in there and they signed up thousands of illegals, they committed vote fraud, they signed up all these undocumented Democrats, and they flipped that state. Now you cannot elect a Republican or a conservative statewide in California for love nor money. Now, as California has the most electoral college votes from every state, and we all know about the electoral college after the last election, right?
Yeah.
That is very important when it comes to presidential elections. Now, the leader of the amnesty movement today is a man called Eliseo Medina. He's a former executive vice president of SEIU, the biggest labor union in your country, private sector labor union. And he was Obama's go-to man on all issues of immigration. He's in my movie. Obama's talking about his friend Eliseo and how he always consults with him on anything to do with immigration. Now, I want to ask you a little question. Any former or current labor union members here tonight? I'm not trying to persecute anybody, just want to know. Okay, it's quite a few. Tell me, cast your minds back, folks. Which organization in America 30 years ago was the most hardcore, militantly opposed to illegal immigration? Which organization was constantly lobbying Congress to increase penalties on any employer caught employing illegals? The unions. The AFL-CIO. Cesar Chavez and the farm workers. And they influenced the Democrats to have the same stand. It was the Democrats, Harry Reid and Bill Clinton, who used to make the great speeches condemning illegal immigration, folks. You want to check it out on YouTube, the way they used to go on about it was a danger to national security, it damaged American workers, it was a disaster. back when it was a quarter of a million a year. Now it's a million a year, or it has been. But so the unions, they had people on the border. Cesar Chavez used to have a woman in his organization whose job was to go out into the fields and find illegal immigrants and turn them into the INS. That was her job, because he understood that illegals would break strikes, they would lower wages and conditions, and take jobs away from his union. And the woman he employed to turn in illegals to the INS is now married to Eliseo Medina, the leader of the amnesty movement, people. But the big deal is this. Why was there a flip? Why did the unions, if you look today, who's leading the charge to legalize the illegals? It's the unions, right? The AFL-CIO, SEIU, they're hardcore pushing for amnesty all the time. So why the big flip? Well, the flip, the reason is very simple. Before 1994, American labor unions were run by hardcore anti-communist American firsters like Lane Kirkland and George Meany. They were patriots. They loved the country and they looked out for their members. In 1994 and 1995, there was a coup inside the AFL-CIO. The Marxists of Democratic Socialists of America took over the unions. They got their member, John Sweeney, elected as president. He removed the clause in the AFL-CIO's constitution, which banned communists from holding office, took that out, and the Marxists came flooding in. They, all those 60s radicals became labor union organizers and labor union presidents, and they took over every single major labor union in this country. SEIU, AFSCME, United Auto Workers, Teamsters, you name it, they now run it. Now you may say, well, big deal, you know, unions are 11% of the workforce. Not like they used to be when they were 30%. You tell me this. You tell me one elected Democrat in this country, from county commission to federal level, school board the whole lot, who does not owe his job to some labor union help. For money, for manpower, for endorsements, for get out the vote, even for vote fraud. Tell me one Democrat who doesn't owe his job to the unions. Do you think John Tester would have got elected without the unions?
No.
You think Steve Bullock would have got elected without the unions? No. So they owe the unions, people. So it's very simple. The communists control the unions. The unions control the Democratic Party. The communists set a policy, normalization of relations with Cuba, nuclear deal with Iran, a fracking ban, you know, Obamacare, all started as communist policies. The communists make them union policy and the unions make them Democrat policy. 15,000 to 20,000 communists in this country were running the Democratic Party agenda all through the Obama administration, and they're still running the Democrats today. So it's very simple. You had the Democrats, that basically the communists took over the unions, and Eliseo Medina lobbied inside the AFL-CIO to get them to flip their policy from complete opposition to illegal immigration to complete support for amnesty. And he achieved that at their national convention in Los Angeles in 2000. And from that point, the unions have been 100% behind amnesty. Now the big, and Eliseo Medina was the man who got the amnesty bill pushed through your Senate about 3 years ago, and thankfully, thanks to the Tea Party, that didn't go through the Congress, thankfully. But the big reason, big thing is this, so why are the left so hardcore, hell-bent on amnesty for illegals? When a lot of their own base doesn't want it, where it's going to hurt the union guys, it's going to take jobs away, lower wages and conditions. Why are they hell-bent on doing it? Well, Eliseo Medina, I've got him on tape in my movie. You can see him on tape saying this. He gets up in front of a big progressive crowd in Washington, D.C. in 2009, and he says this: passing amnesty, giving illegal immigrants, the 11 million undocumented workers in our country, giving them citizenship and voting rights is the number one priority of the progressive movement. And does he talk about compassion or giving immigrants a break or reuniting families or the American way? Not a word, people. All he said was this: in 2008, Latinos voted overwhelmingly for Obama and progressive candidates. If we stand by these people, they will stand with our movement. That will give us at least 8 million more Democratic Party votes. That will give us a governing majority, not just for the next few election cycles, forever. Think about it, people. There are between 12 and 30 million illegals in this country right now. They will vote at least 80% Democrat. Mitt Romney lost his election by 2.5 million votes. Donald Trump won his election by about 200,000. You give the Democrats between 8 and 24 million new votes, where does that leave you, people? Where does that leave you? Why do you think Hillary Clinton promised she was going to legalize every illegal immigrant and give them citizenship and voting rights within 100 days of assuming office? Did you catch that? But that's what she promised. Why do you think Barack Obama went hell-bent to try and pass amnesty before the 2014 election, knowing it was hugely unpopular and would probably cost him the Senate? Because Obama is a Leninist, and Lenin is all about one step backwards to get two step forward. People, let's give the Republicans the Senate. Doesn't matter, because we'll get amnesty and then we will run the country forever. Forever, people. You are that close to a one-party state. They were going to do to the whole country what they've already done to California, folks. That's their plan. And Sean Hannity tells you, well, yeah, that might make this country like France or Germany. These people are Marxist, Leninist, communist people. They are allied to Cuba and Venezuela and China. They don't want to make you like France or Germany. They want to make you like Venezuela and Cuba not long after. That is their plan, people. And you are this close. You are that close to losing your country. Does anybody think there might have been a touch of the miraculous about election night? Yes. I think there might have been the hand of God on that election ticket. Because we all knew that Hillary was going to win, right? Everybody told us that it had to be Hillary, that it was inevitable, that Donald Trump had no show. But when you saw Florida go to Trump, and then when you saw Ohio go to Trump, did you get a little bit of flutter in your heart, people? Did you get a bit of, wow, something's going on here? And then when it went through the night and the states fell one after the other, did you have a little bit of change of heart? People, one thing stands out for me on that night. Remember when they panned the Democratic Party headquarters about 2 o'clock in the morning? And all these snowflakes are bawling their eyes out and hugging and crying. Now, the Germans have a word. It's called Schadenfreude. And it means taking pleasure in someone else's pain. And it's not a very pleasant thing, right? It's pretty mean emotion. But did you feel a little bit of Schadenfreude that night? And do you think you deserved it after 8 years of Obama?
Yes.
Well, I think you can forgive yourself for that one, people. I think you deserved it, and you deserved every bit of it. But look, you know, what I say about the Trump election is this. I think it was miraculous. But I also think It's not a complete change in direction. It's a second chance to save this country. It's a reprieve. We've been given another shot at this. I heard a Tea Party lady the other night say something like, well, we've got Mr. Trump elected now. We don't really need the Tea Parties now. People, he is getting hammered by the media. He's getting hammered by the rhinos. He's getting hammered by the Democrats, by the Chinese, the North Koreans, by Hollywood, by the labor unions, by the communist Antifa and radicals on the street. He's getting hammered in every direction, people. A lot of his best people have been purged. Don't you think he needs a little bit of help?
Yes.
Did George Washington win your revolution all alone, folks? He had an army behind him, a very committed, very brave and courageous and persevering army. Well, what does Mr. Trump need right now, folks?
An army.
He needs that army. Have you ever said, you know, you look at it, we've been given a second chance. This isn't a change in direction. If Donald Trump fails, it all goes back to where it started. We've been given another go. And if you look at the Bible, there's a lot of second chances in the Old Testament, right?
Yeah.
You know, the Israelites, you've gone off the farm. You're not doing what you should do. I'm going to give you another chance. But how many third chances were in the Old Testament, people?
No.
How many third chances do you get when you get against, with great mercy, you've let the country slide for 100 years, and you're given one more chance to turn it around? And you say, well, I'm going to have a holiday now, but I'll come back for another chance later. How do you think that's going to go? So that's how I feel it, people. We are being given a reprieve, and we better darn well use it. Now, has anybody seen the depth of hatred and vitriol and just viciousness from the left against the president than you've seen against Donald Trump? Even Reagan, even George Bush too didn't get this kind of stuff. Melania, they criticize her shoes. Doesn't matter anything to bring this man down. So why do they hate him so much? Well, exactly. Well, I'm going to go into that and explain what I think it is. Now, see, the left, they knew that if Hillary Clinton was the president, they were going to get amnesty. They were going to get a massive increase in Islamic refugee resettlement. And they were going to make you a permanent minority. You were never going to be able to bother them again. And they were going to be able to come after you and shut you down. They were salivating, people. They were fired up. And they knew they had you. And they just had to get across the finish line. And 60 years of work, they were going to have their revolution. They were so excited. And they, on election night, they were like a bunch of kids who thought they were going to get their best bike you've ever seen. And they woke up to a pair of socks, folks. And they are gutted. They are angry. They're disappointed. But it's even more than that. Because they know that they had the one-party state within their grasp. And they're looking at what Donald Trump could do. And they're freaking out that if he is successful, all of that work is going to crumble away. Because see, if you're a Democrat, you think you own the black population, right? Every black person has got to vote Democrat, right? And you own the Native Americans. And you own the Latinos. And you own the gays. And you own the Muslim Americans. And you own the Latinos. You own them. These are your base. You own the white union guys in Pennsylvania and Ohio. That's your base. And that is what keeps you in power and gets you elected. And when Donald Trump went out to those white union guys in Pennsylvania and said, hey, I don't see a lot of jobs here, guys. I see a lot of closed down factories. Is this what the Democrats have done for you? Why didn't you vote for me? I'm going to bring the jobs back and the factories back. And they said, heck yeah. And they crossed over. And he went to the black communities and said, look, I'm not seeing a lot of prosperity in some of these black-controlled cities, these Democrat-controlled cities. I'm seeing a lot of drugs and a lot of crime. I'm seeing a lot of desperation here. Why don't you vote for me? What have you got to lose? And a lot of them said, heck yeah, what have we got to lose? And they crossed over. And they all, the Democrats will tell you that every Latino supports amnesty. All illegal Latinos here who contribute to the economy, been here for decades, they all support amnesty. They don't, people. And when Donald Trump said he was going to build a wall and he was going to stop that criminal activity, they said, yeah, he's our man. And they voted for him too. And that was enough to cross the line, people. That was enough. So the Democrats are freaking out. Because if they know, if Donald Trump can get a successful economy going, he can rebring the jobs back to the Rust Belt, if he can stop the flow of drugs, and the only reason the drugs and the heroin are so endemic in your country right now is because of the open borders, that they allow it to stay open to keep their voters coming across. They know if he can shut down those problems, if he can open up the energy field so you can drill your own oil and pump your own gas, they know if he can get the taxes down and the regulations off business, they know that the money will flow back into this country. The checkbooks will open up, trillions of dollars will be invested, and you will have an economic boom like you've never seen before. And they know if that happens, they are out of power for 50 years. They know they're done, people. So do you see how desperate they are? They have to stop Trump. They are cornered rats. And which kind of rat is more vicious than a cornered rat, folks? They know if Trump is a successful president, they are done. They're out of power for decades, their party will be smashed, and you'll have a whole change in the politics of this country. You see the stakes, how they see it? They almost had a one-party state. It was taken away from them, and now they're in danger of losing their power across the country. You think they might be a little bit desperate and vicious people? That's why they're so angry and just unrelentingly hostile. See, but this is the plan that they have for coming back, you know? Cornered rats still have a plan. Now, they understand that if they can stop Mr. Trump, if they can make sure the wall isn't built, if they can make sure the taxes don't come down, that Obama's hair still hangs around your neck, that the jobs don't come back to the inner cities, that the energy fields aren't opened up, they understand that a lot of this base will stay home in 2018 and 2020. And that's their chance to take back the House and the Senate and then the presidency. And then it all rolls on, people. Then they open up, then they amnesty everybody who's here. All the illegals that are here, they amp up the refugee resettlement from the Middle East, and they will have you. They will not make this mistake again, people. That's why they're trying to shut down the internet now, but they're trying to get on top of Fox News. They want to take away your voice so this can never, ever happen again. They learned something from this last election, people. They learned that pride comes before the fall, and they're going to make sure they don't make that mistake again. So their plan is very simple. Stop Trump every way you can. Subpoena him. Do everything you can to stop him. Denigrate him. Tear down his support base. Isolate him. Anything you can to slow him down and stop him. The second part of their plan is a little more sophisticated. Who remembers the old Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition of the 1980s? Good old criminal Jesse Jackson, right? Well, he ran for president twice. The second time he got 7 million votes, which was considered quite respectable at the time. Now, his plan was this. You get the radical whites, you get the radical blacks, the communist progressive blacks, the Native Americans, the radical gays, the radical Asian Americans, the Latinos, white, black, brown, lavender, red, yellow, the Rainbow Coalition. That's what it was. And you build all of this into an alliance that can become a majority. But they didn't have enough people then. You know, the demographics were different. He did well, but he couldn't get enough to break through. Well, there's a man in San Francisco called Stephen Phillips. He used to work for Jesse Jackson. He worked for a whole year in his campaign. He was also a Maoist, a member of the League of Revolutionary Struggle at Stanford University, a heavily communist group. And in 1990, Steve Phillips and all his comrades, they dissolved that group and they moved into the Democratic Party. And then Steve Phillips married into the very, very wealthy Sandler family from San Francisco, worth billions of dollars, and moved up the ranks of the Democratic Party. And he used that money to get behind candidates of color all over the country. He was one of the first people to fund Barack Obama. He's now getting behind Ben Jealous of the NAACP, who's running for the governorship of Maryland. He's backing Stacey Abrams, who is running for the governorship of Georgia. They're backing Tulsi Gabbard from Hawaii, Mazie Hirono from Hawaii. They're getting behind these candidates all over the country, and they're putting huge amounts of money in voter registration drives and get out the vote efforts in the southern states, Arizona, Texas, New Mexico, North Carolina, Virginia, Florida, etc. Now, Mr. Phillips also had a couple of friends at Stanford. One of them was a man called Cory Booker, who's now the senator from New Jersey. Black guy, and Mr. Phillips funded him as well. And he also had another friend whose sister was just elected as a senator from California, Kamala Harris. And she is half black, half Asian. So what Mr. Phillips is doing right now is telling the Democrats, he's got a book out there called Brown is the New White, endorsed by Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama, and he's telling the Democrats, don't go back to the middle. Don't try and get the middle voters anymore. You're wasting your time. Go hardcore for your progressive people of color base. And his theory is very simple. This is his math. 25% of the electorate are progressives of color. They are black, Latino, Asian American, Native American, Muslim American, gay American. They put the gays in there as well, right? 26% of the electorate are white progressives. They will vote Democrat no matter who is on the ticket. They are locked in. 26 plus 25 makes 51. The new American majority. So their plan is very simple. Smash Donald Trump as much as you can, destroy his base, do massive voter registration in the southern states, in Florida, Texas, Georgia, work to flip those states, and then in 2020, they're going to run Cory Booker and Kamala Harris to inspire the black, the Latino, the Asian American base. They're going to rebuild the Rainbow Coalition. And they think that is going to give them 51, 52, 53% of the vote. That will win them the election. They will then legalize every illegal in the country. They will flood the country, especially the conservative states, with Muslim refugees, and they will have you. That is their plan. Does that sound in any way far-fetched, people?
No.
This is what they do. This is how they work. So we have a choice. We have an upside and a downside here. The downside is we can sit back and we can cruise and hope and pray that Donald Trump wins in 2018 and 2020. We hold the House, we hold the Senate, we can hope that happens. But I don't want to, if you want to rely on hope when it comes to your, just blind luck when it comes to the future of your country. Or we can do every single thing we can to make sure this presidency is a successful one and we hold the House in 2018 and increase our majority in the Senate with real conservatives. And then we win in 2020, either with Donald Trump or his successor. Now, Steve Bannon, who was in the White House but now he's out. Well, I'm actually glad he's out. Because he was down in Alabama recently campaigning for a man called Roy Moore.
Yeah.
Very good conservative constitutional guy. Very good guy. He won that primary. He's going to be the next senator from Alabama. Well, Bannon's not stopping there. His plan is this. There's going to be about 24 Democratic senators up for election in 2018 and only 8 Republicans. So obviously we have to pick off the vulnerable Democrats like John Tester. That's your job, people. Because you've got to understand that Mr. Trump does not have a majority in the Senate. He's got a majority of Republicans, but you can't call Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and John McCain real Republicans, can you not? So he can't get stuff through. So he needs another 5 or 6 or 7 real conservatives in there to back him. So Steve Bannon is looking at those 8 Republican seats that are up for election, and he's going to primary every single one of them except for Ted Cruz in Texas, right? Because Cruz is already on our side. He's already a constitutionalist. So if he can do that, and we can get behind him, and he can flip 4 or 5 of those seats, if he can, say, take 2 or 3 seats or 4 or 5 of the Democrats, but more importantly, get 5 or 6 more real conservatives into those Senate seats, what a difference that might make, people. What a huge difference in the direction this country could take. Now, people say, oh, elections don't matter, who cares? You tell me, people, you tell me what this country would have been like if Jimmy Carter had won 2 terms. If Ronald Reagan had never been elected. If the Soviet Union was still there. If you never had the economic boom of the 1980s. You tell me what this country would look like today, folks. It doesn't bear thinking about it, does it? Well, we have that same opportunity right now. Donald Trump could be a 1-term president, then the Democrats rule forever, or he could be a 2-term president, or a successor could take over from him and could change the economy, work to get back to the Constitution, just alter this country in ways like you could never imagine. But he needs the votes to do it. And that is our job as the army, to deliver those votes. That's what we can do. So this is our choice. We can sit back and do nothing, or we can give it everything we've got to make sure that this country elects good people to lead it over the next 2 election cycles, then hold their feet to the fire to make sure they do what they need to do there on after. Those are our 2 options. Now, I can't promise you very much, folks, but I can promise you 2 things. If you give it everything that's within you over the next 3 years for your God, your Constitution, your country, and your family, and are any things more worth fighting for than those things? No. If you give it everything you've got and put your heart and soul into it, 2 things could happen. The first is you could do all of that and still lose. But at least you will earn the right to look your children in the eye and say, I did everything I possibly could. What is that worth to you, people? And if you win, and you can win, people, because God is not finished with this country yet, folks.
Right.
If you win and you can turn this country around, you can spark an economic boom, but even greater than that, you can spark a liberty boom all over this planet, folks. Brexit could just be the first step. Don't you think the French want freedom? Don't you think the Germans want freedom? The Russians want freedom? Don't you think the Aussies and the New Zealanders want freedom? But that depends on what happens here. If you can turn your country around, if you can restore your constitution, you restore your economy, restore your military superiority, you can set an example for freedom lovers all over the world, folks. You can give your children not just the amazing country that you inherited, but one even greater. Is that worth fighting for?
Yes.
So I want to say to you, people, thank you so much for what you do for America, for my country, and for liberty. God bless America, and God bless Montana, and God bless you all. Thank you very much. Questions. I know some of you may need to go, but I just want to say one thing, a bit of self-promotion before I take questions. The books and the DVDs are what funds my travel.